For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so last week we began studying the whole question of the relationship of the believing community, the church, to the broader social context in which God has planted us. And we made the point that there are important similarities between the ancient Roman culture and contemporary, what's sometimes called postmodern American culture. And we want to tease some of those similarities out again tonight, some by way of review, but also as a launch pad into some very specific issues that were on the minds of the first century world and which are very much on the minds of people today. So our text is 1 Peter 3, starting in verse 15, where he says, "Set apart Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is within you." And yet he says, "With gentleness and reverence, and keep a good conscience, so that in the things that you're slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may also be put to shame." So what is Peter saying here? Let's take a little bit of time to review. The point that we made last time is that one of the real key similarities between ancient Roman culture and contemporary Western culture is that it's very pluralistic by nature. Rome was the cosmopolis, the world city. All roads led to Rome, and throughout the empire, there's an enormous amount of ethnic and language diversity, people with different religious systems, and they're all coming together. And what happens in that kind of an environment, which is also true certainly of today in the modern melting pot that is American culture, is that that incredible and in many ways beautiful diversity where people just are from different life experiences, different cultural contexts come together, is that it also subverts the kind of certainties that maybe have driven them as a people in the past. And the more isolated a people is, the more certainty that they feel about their ideas about what's reality, what God is all about, and stuff like that. And you may also kind of, from your background, have grown up with certain certainties that maybe you learned in church or in a synagogue or wherever it was that you came from. And then you begin to interface with people with different backgrounds, different beliefs. And what it does is it creates something in the psyche of people who live in a broadly pluralistic culture, which is that they begin to have a looser grip on their own beliefs in the knowledge of what is really out there. And so, you know, how can I say I've got the inside track on what's true when I look at my neighbor who's into something very different, and they don't agree with me at all, but they have that same sort of certainty I do. So it doesn't take long to connect the dots that, you know, maybe a fresh look at the things that are really important in our own belief systems have to come under a different kind of process and analysis in a pluralistic culture than perhaps would occur if we didn't have that tension and that cool synergy within our own cultures. In the Greek world, skepticism was a very prevalent idea, just as it is today. We ask the question, "Who says so?" When someone puts forth an idea, you know, "This is the way it is." "Oh yes," yeah, says who? We always ask, because for any expert we can find, and one who believes one thing, we can find an expert who believes something very different. And so we have become very skeptical people as a culture. We don't hold on to our beliefs all that tight. Because there is in the nagging in the back of my mind, gosh, I could really be wrong, and this person who lives next door to me, maybe they've got it together. Maybe they understand what it is, and I don't. And the consequence of this is that in the Roman world, as in the contemporary American culture, that we have come to have more of a sense of the privatized beliefs. That is to say that I'm really trying to figure it out for me. You know, it's my belief, it's my tradition maybe, it's the things that I'm convinced of, but I would not want to say to the next door neighbor who maybe believes something slightly different or maybe radically different, well, what I believe isn't just true in some kind of personal sense, but it's really true for you as well. We're really reluctant to do that. Most of us here this evening would be very reluctant to just mix it up and start talking about what it is that I think, what do I believe in a culture where we know that people don't hold those views. And so as a kind of a rule of social etiquette, and of course there are some ideas that drive this as well, in the ancient world as in the modern, we tend to view the big questions of life, you know, who am I? Who is God? What's it all about? What happens to me when I die? How should I live my life? What does God want for me? We tend to put these kinds of things in the category of matters of taste rather than in matters of fact. And we reserve the realm of facts just for things that maybe we could measure under a microscope or through a telescope, something that we could see with our senses. Anything outside of that, we more or less relegate to, well, it's, you know, this is what I'm into and this is what I like, and, you know, God bless you. I hope you find something for you too. And it's sort of like the idea that we hold our deep beliefs kind of like the way people share their preferences about ice cream. And we could say, you know, I'm really, really excited about French vanilla. And to me, you know, that stuff rocks, you know, especially Breyers, you know, where you got those little nutty things in there and stuff like that. But I would not want to say to the person like Lee who says, vanilla is a wimpy ice cream. I wouldn't say, man, you are so wrong and you need to get it together and see the way it is, that vanilla ice cream is really the best. He'd say to me, as he's saying to himself right now, that dude is flipped, man. He's lost his mind. You don't argue about things that are just matters of taste. You only argue about things that are tangible, that are real, that are matters of fact, and that, you know, something's at stake. Somebody could be wrong. Well, you know, the funny thing is that the Bible says that when God has, that God's existence, the way that he has revealed himself through the Bible and personally through his son and what he had to say when he walked the earth, really are not matters of taste. But he's there to say this is really the God's eye view. The only way you could know what's really true is if God himself, I suppose, spoke. And that's the claim of the Bible. And so in that sense then, most Christians find themselves with a certain level of tension about their belief, knowing that the general cultural attitude is that our deep beliefs are matters of personal preference, they're matters of taste, and yet we know that God has not communicated in those terms, that he's got an umbrella that encompasses all people in all places and times and says it's true for everybody. So we've got that little internal tension going. In the broader sense, in our culture, there are effects or implications to this kind of a private view of my beliefs, that they're matters of taste, not matters of fact. And we talked about this some last time, that there's a lot of confusion in our culture because we don't take ideas all that seriously you don't take your ice cream choice all that seriously either. It's just, this is what I like, this is what I'm used to, this is what I'm into. And so as a result, most people in our culture are profoundly confused about what it is that they believe anyway. And most people maybe would identify themselves, many would at least, with a particular religious tradition, but have very little understanding of what does that tradition really teach? What does it mean? And why would a reasonable person believe such things? So we're confused. And therefore, you know, in the laboratory of reality, it's very difficult to rely on beliefs that we have more or less chosen because they're comfortable to us, or because we're accustomed to them, or because we like it for some reason. When the test of reality and the pressures of reality bear on our life, and we're looking for answers, but our answers we know are just more or less our own choice to believe, well, then we don't have a very good foundation to stand on at that point. Nothing real to appeal to or to hold on to. And as a consequence then, in Roman culture and in contemporary American culture, people who, because we don't have a real foundation for what we believe, are easily manipulated by the social influences around us. We begin to adopt outlooks and attitudes, sometimes without even consciously being aware of them. Last time we talked about the persuaders, the whole frontline piece on how advertising keys in on the confusion of our culture in a very deliberate way to mold and shape people's attitudes and to market products in keeping with those attitudes. And it's true in general culture, it's true in the business world. My own background is in the academic environment, and I see it there as well. Several years ago, I was interacting with a psychology professor at New York University who had become a Christian after many years of being an agnostic. And in looking back, he makes a really important point. I just thought I would quote him here. He says, "It's difficult to document such a thing as a general attitude of a profession." He says, "But the hostility of most psychologists to Christianity is very real. For years, I was part of that sentiment. Today, it still surrounds me. It is a curious hostility," he says, "for most psychologists are not aware of it. Their lack of awareness is due mostly to sheer ignorance of what Christianity is, or for that matter, of what any religion is. The universities are so secularized that most academics can no longer articulate why they are opposed to Christianity. They merely assume that for all rational people, the question of being a Christian was settled negatively at some time in the past." And so that atheistic kind of attitude never really carefully analyzed or assessed what is the data, what are the arguments. It's just assumed that that's the way it is. And so if we don't have firm roots for our belief, then we will be intimidated, we will be manipulated by whatever voice seems to be the most persuasive in our culture. I think that that's a serious problem, whether you're here tonight as a Christian or as someone who's seeking after God, to realize that there's a lot at stake. And you may view yourself as this rugged individualist, I do it on my own, I think for myself and stuff like that. But the reality is that the pressures of our society and its attitudes and its outlook are much greater than you, and you will be conformed to its outlook in a profound way and in a damaging way as well. Because in the final account, our last point here from last week, is that if all that we believe is simply just a matter of what I choose to believe, and therefore it's somehow true for me, well, you know, what about the person who doesn't have that belief and has chosen something else? Now, how do I connect with them? And the reality is that as human beings, we all have a need to connect on a deep level. You know, that successful and intimate relationships are not just a matter of the fact that we maybe like the same kinds of things, we have the same hobbies, or that we've gone out on eHarmony.com and found the female version of ourselves to fall in love with or whatever, but that we realize that we need to connect, you know, heart to heart, person to person, spirit to spirit. And if there is no real basis from which to draw our lives, then we don't have that opportunity. We can't connect in an ongoing way, in an abiding way, in a deepening way in relationship, because we simply don't have that foundation. So there's really a lot at stake, and I think it's for this reason that people are so inarticulate about what it is that they believe. And my beliefs, even in the context of marriage, often are, well, that's, you know, he's into his thing and I'm into mine, or whatever it is. And we cannot drill down and connect about the most important parts of who we are as people and what makes us tick and have a partnership that's really rooted in something real. So we've got problems as a culture today, just like the Romans had a significant problem in their culture in the first century world. Now let's just dig in a little bit deeper, because Peter's going to say, now here's, we need to understand as a community of people who have found God through Jesus Christ, that we have a role to play in this society. And the role that he describes in 1 Peter, and certainly in this passage, really manifests itself in a couple of ways. First has to do with you know, what we are like as people. He says gentleness and reverence, you know, that those are the attitudes that should guide the way that we interact with people, the way that we should interact with one another, the idea of a conscience being kind of the barometer of what does it mean for me to move towards another person. But the idea is that Christians, in how we live our lives, really stand out as sort of living evidence of the truth that we proclaim. And the idea is that how Christians live before others really does matter. It's not just the message that we speak and now go your own way, But it's a community of people who are saying, you know, the message is be reconciled to God through Christ. But if we're not living out what it looks like to be reconciled to another person in our relationships, in our Christian community, then, you know, what we have to say sounds very hollow and very shallow and very empty. And this is why Jesus says, you know, my people, I want them to be salt and light. And how we live our lives, you know, salt's what gives food taste. You know, it's interesting and it's spicy and this type of thing. And sort of light, you know, that this is what it looks like to really know God. And he's saying that's super important. Not just what you say, but how you live your life. Because to hear the truth, you often have to see the truth. And that's certainly true in my experience. I am a slow learner, like some of us here tonight. And I don't oftentimes understand how something works until I see it in action. I see how it works, and therefore I get an idea of, oh, okay, this is what it means. And I think that that's the way it is for people who are seeking after God. They wonder, what does this really look like? Before I'm really open and interested in what you have to say, I want to see a picture of this. And is, you know, because the proof of the pudding is in the eating, the same thing I think God is saying here. You know, let's show what's true by the way that we live our lives. I really like the way the historian Roland Allen puts it like this. He's talking about the church in China and comparing that also to the first century Roman world. And he says it was the irresistible attraction of the Christian church for men who see in its ordered life and are drawn to it by a desire to discover the secret of a life which they instinctively desire to share. I wonder if that would characterize your home group and the network of relationships that you have. You know, where real forgiveness is extended to people, where real care about the concerns of their life are expressed, where there's a community of people and they've got each other's backs in a real way, and they're deeply involved and they care about their families and they're moving forward in life together. You know, that's a beautiful picture. That's a picture of reconciliation with God. And when people look at that and say, I don't have the capacity to forgive, and I don't have a way to really reconcile in a deep way, and I don't know what it looks like to really cultivate deep love, satisfying relationships with other people, but I see that you do. I want what you have. And that is always the pattern in the scripture, and I think in our experience when we are being effectively used by God. This dimension of it is absolutely crucial. But then he goes on and he says, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is within you. And so here's another issue. Not merely in how do I live my life, but the ability of Christians to give a real defense. And the word, as we talked about last time, apologia, is a courtroom term. And he's saying you need to be able to piece together the legitimate criticisms, the honest questions that people in our culture have, and you need to be able to engage them and answer those questions. Honest answers to honest questions is fundamental to what does it mean to be a Christian in the world. And that's what I want to focus our attention on then here over the next few weeks, because there is kind of a framework of questions that I think are very common in our culture and which we need to have reasoned, persuasive, biblical, forward-looking responses to. Think about this. I think that the real issue in the Roman world as it is today is not the content of what Christians believe. It's the implications of what they believe that really raises questions in people's minds. You know, in the Roman world, it didn't matter what God you worshipped. It didn't matter at all. And I think to a large extent, it doesn't matter today either. No one really cares what you believe. But people are very sensitive to the implications of what you believe. And so one of those implications that was really true in the Roman world is that because they believed that Jesus Christ was the Lord and there's only one God, that they, no, we will not venerate an image of Caesar and bow down and worship his image. That's true. But it's not true. The implication that Peter finds himself responding to is that therefore Christians threaten the unity of the state. And Peter is at pains to say, we're not about sedition. We're not about a revolution. We're going to subordinate ourselves to the state. That's what chapter 2 is really all about. Another implication that was sensitive in the mind of the Romans was the fact that Christians taught and lived out equality. Equality in the family, men and women. Equality in the marketplace, slaves and free. In the church of the first century, a slave and his or her master would sit down together as equals in the body of Christ. As equals. And that raised real questions in the mind of the onlooking Romans who were deeply vested in slavery, namely the fear that Christians encouraged slave revolt. And so Peter is very interested in engaging that issue. So you see, the point is that there are implications that follow from what we believe, and those implications are the things that people react to, respond to, and that we need to be able to address in a compassionate yet compelling way. Well, what are the implications of biblical faith in our culture that raise real questions with people? I think that there's a narrow circle of them that are absolutely fundamental to our ability to even begin to have honest discussion about Jesus Christ. Here's one: the fact that the Bible makes very exclusive claims about God's revelation through Jesus Christ. And Jesus says in John 14, verse 6, I am the way. Not I am a way. I am the way. I am not a truth, I am the truth. And he says, I am the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. That's a very difficult pill for most people in our culture today to swallow. Peter, the same author of this letter, says in Acts chapter 4, verse 2, there is salvation in no one else. And so you have this claim to an exclusive message that the Bible provides the umbrella of truth that's true for all people in all places in all times. Boy, that just doesn't sit real well with a culture that is as diverse, is as pluralistic, and has adopted the idea that truth is just a matter of what do I believe? What's good for me? What do I think? That's really the only question that we need to ask. But it raises very poignant points. Like the fact that, look, what are we saying about sincere believers who are on different paths? What about them? Are we prepared to say, well, they must be wrong? I know that there are many non-Christians who are interested spiritually in our culture who will not move beyond this point. If what you're saying is that the message of the Bible is the giant umbrella under which all truth ultimately rests about who is God, no thanks, I'm not interested. That's a deal breaker, I'm out of here. And we need to look at that implication, and we're going to do that here a little bit tonight. What about the people who've never heard of this message? Well, it doesn't really do them much good, does it, that this is the way, the truth, and the life? Does it? And so there's that concern about, you know, the person who is brought up in, you know, Borneo or something like that. How can they be accountable? How can they be responsible for something that they have never heard and are guilty of nothing other than an accident of birth? That's a problem. And then there's a false implication also that I want us to interact with just a little bit. The idea that Christianity is inherently intolerant. And I want us to talk about that. That'll be the first thing we talk about here this evening along these objections. Because this is the real great issue of our day. That the idea that I actually believe something to be true and true, not just out of personal preference, but true because it really is true for everyone, it's a matter of fact, is something that when many people think about that in our culture, say that by definition is intolerant. Because now you're generalizing and putting your truth on everybody. Well, let's think about that just a little bit. We're going to basically work our way backwards through these three bullet points. What is tolerance, and what does it mean to be tolerant? Let's just start there for a second. When we say, you know, so-and-so is a tolerant person, or in a broader sense, we live in a tolerant culture. What are we exactly saying? Well, it used to be when we used the word tolerant, what we meant is that a tolerant culture and tolerant people are prepared to engage in civilized disagreement with one another, giving people the space and dignity to believe as their conscience leads. But the point is that we're prepared to interact and to discuss and to dialogue and even to say, you know, I think you're out of your mind for believing these things that you believe. No, there's no such thing as leprechauns. But I believe that you have the right to believe that, and I stand behind that right. I'm not on your case because you believe something that I think is, well, odd. And so the idea of civil dialogue, civil discussion about matters of truth, where people could actually, you know, sometimes be very heated in their disagreements, but at the end of the day shake hands and say, I acknowledge your prerogative and your belief and your right to believe whatever you want. And maybe we'll get back to this issue another time. You know, it's kind of like years ago I taught philosophy of religion in the philosophy department at Ohio Dominican University. And one of the exercises I asked students to do is to go to the newspaper and say, what is our culture saying about religion? And here's one of the articles that came back in an assignment that I held on to because I thought it was so interesting and such a good window into this whole topic. It's Dear Abby, and someone's writing to Dear Abby, and he says, your answer to the woman who complained that her relatives were always arguing with her about religion was ridiculous. He says, you advise her to simply declare the subject off limits. Are you suggesting that people talk about only trivial, meaningless subjects so as to avoid a potential controversy? Part of society's problem today is that so many people talk about only shallow and petty things and never examine the deeper topics. It is arrogant to tell people that there are subjects that they may not mention in your presence. You could have suggested she learn enough about her relative's cult to show them the errors in its teaching. Well, that's the old view of tolerance. You can believe whatever you want, you have that freedom, but, you know, it's open dialogue. We can talk about these things. There's an argument to be made. What about this woman's cult? You know, maybe it's a real debasing and demeaning thing. Maybe she's being mind-washed or whatever. And certainly, it would be an appropriate thing to say, you know, how come you believe that stuff? Can we talk about that? And that's what we used to mean by tolerant, the freedom to engage in those kinds of discussions. But here's the shift, and Abby says it so very well. Dear conversant, in my view, the height of arrogance is to attempt to show people the errors in the religion of their choice. Now, what is Abby saying? Who's got a thought? What does Abby mean in her response to our conversant? Yeah, it's arrogant to say, you might be wrong.
Right. My way's right, right. Your way's wrong.
Because it's true, because it's a matter of taste, because I've chosen to believe it. And who are you to say, my ice cream is not as good as yours? Good. Other thoughts? What does it mean? Okay, so that's an important point, that there's a lot at stake in what people believe and how we handle differences on important matters like this. You know, is really a kind of a moral issue. Maybe that's why Peter says, you know, with gentleness and real reverence for other people. Anybody else got a thought? Exactly. It assumes that there's nothing really at stake to talk about because at the end of the day, one person's belief is just as sound as any other. It's rooted in what do I choose? There is no room for debate about things like that. And that is tolerance as it is more or less expressed in our culture today. And to engage someone in critical discussion about what it is you believe is the dynamic equivalent of farting in church. It's just something that you don't do. Okay? Now, never disagree. Why would you disagree over a person's choice of fashion or style or something like that? Of course that's intolerant. Of course that's stupid. But what about discussing matters of fact? So here's a person who's been diagnosed with a terrible disease. And you know, the fact of the matter is that that disease will take their life. But good news, there's a cure. And so you sit down with this person, says, well, you know, what's the doctor telling you? And you're saying, and they say to you, doctor, what doctor? I don't need a doctor. You know, I just keep reciting this poem and I'm sure that my problem will go away. What do you say to that person? Well, I respect your right to believe that, but you are a fool. You're a fool. Don't do this to yourself. Don't do this to the people who love you. It doesn't have to be this way, right? Because we love them. Not because we're judging them or impugning their right to believe what they want. We're saying, because I care for you, living something that is wrong, is false, it does not help your cause. And so it is with matters of fact. Now, I realize that God, as a matter of fact, is a lot harder to get at than a disease or something like that. But the principle remains the same. It's not a matter of taste. It is a matter of fact. Let's apply this to the religious context. Maybe you've heard the famous parable of the elephant and the blind people. Remember that story? Anybody heard that story before? Okay, so you know the diversity of the world's religions are kind of like an elephant, and you got these blind people around, and so this blind person feels the trunk, and what does he think the elephant is? It's a tree. And the other person feels the broad, hard sides of the elephant. And what does she think the elephant is? You know, it's a barn. And another person, feels the trunk of the elephant. And what do they think, you know, it is that they're handling here? You know, maybe a fire hose or something like that. And so the argument is, well, you know, that's the way it is sort of with the God question. Everyone has their own little experience, their own little insight into the truth, that all paths lead to the same summit. We're just on different pathways. And at the end of the day, what we need to do is exercise this kind of tolerance that says it would be wrong for me to question the legitimacy of your path, because I know that at the end of the day, we're all going to meet at the same end anyway. Does that sound familiar to you? That, I think, is the dominant way of viewing religious pluralism in our culture. But I want to say just a couple of things about that. Namely, that as a matter of fact, faiths differ very sharply on the question of who is God, what is God like, the question of the afterlife, and very importantly, how do we get from here to there? Which raises real questions about the power of the metaphor of the elephant, the idea that somehow we all meet at the same summit. Because if there really is a summit, if there really is a God, if that's objectively true and not just a projection of my imagination or yours, then how would it be reconcilable, for instance, to say, as the Bible does, that God is an infinite person, that he has a will, that God is rational, that he has a purpose for your life, that he is essentially moral by nature, and that we're going to interact with God forever, as opposed to, say, an Asian view that would say, you know, God is essentially not personal, he's more like an energy force or something like that, and God is a part of nature and God is a part of you and we're all part of God and God is the cosmic one. You know, how can both of those visions of God both be true? It seems like it's not possible that they could both be true. You know, in an Asian take on the afterlife, the idea of nirvana, nirvana means the extinguishing. It means like the little kid peeing into the bathtub. And where you merge in with the rest of the water, and there's no longer that individual identifiable stream. It's all just one, and you no longer exist as an individual. You don't know that you are any longer. And so that's the picture that Hinduism and most forms of Buddhism present to us about what is the afterlife. How is that consistent with the idea of experiencing the person of God as an individual forever, which would be a biblical view? And again, I'm just shooting for very basic kind of contrasts here to illustrate the point that it would be mistaken of us to say that all religions essentially in their own way are teaching the same kinds of things. The fact of the matter is that they are not. And very importantly, in terms of how do we get from our present condition into the presence of God. And see, all religion outside the Bible, all religion teaches that you approach God by the virtue of your disciplines, whether that's the Eightfold Path rooted in the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism, whether it is the deliberateness of your meditative practice as a Hindu, or how good you are according to the rules of the game in Islam or in Judaism. And so we present our work before God and say, it's good enough, ain't it? And then we kind of wonder to ourselves, you know, is it really? And in a singularly unique way, the message of the Bible and the message of Jesus Christ is that God has a fundamentally different way, an irreconcilable way. A way that's irreconcilable with the path of good work, which is the path of humility that says, God, I know that I am alienated from you. That my problem isn't that I just don't know in an experiential way my connection with the all that is you, but I realize that I'm alienated from you because I'm a sinful person. I've gone my own way. I am guilty before a moral God. And I just want to plead with you, God, that you would forgive me. And the good news of the Bible is that God responds to that plea. That's what grace means. It's not something that you say before a meal or something like that. Grace means gift. And we approach God on the basis not of what we have done for him, but on the basis of what he has done for us. And that's just not reconcilable with the pathway that says, I'm going to get there one good work at a time. They're not reconcilable. And so the elephant metaphor, while it's obviously attractive, everybody loves elephants, really does not do justice to what the real issue is. That all religions can't be the path to the same summit because they teach fundamentally different things. And I have found as well, some years ago, we went to Japan speak at a conference. And one of the things that was very interesting there was how people were reporting, you know, Japanese religious leaders and intellectuals were deeply and profoundly offended by Westerners who had come in to say, you know, all religion basically is the same, it's a different face of God or whatever. You know, they were very insistent as Buddhists and as Shintos that how could you demean our faith by watering it down and saying it's basically teaching the same thing as Christianity or Islam or something else like that. The reality is that people who really believe what they believe don't see what we want to believe, that it's all a collage and it's all the same thing. Because real believers believe that what they have understood and what they have thought through is true in an objective sense. And that really it's arrogant, it's closed-minded, it does not take into consideration the real value of their beliefs to basically water it down and say, we're reading off the same page after all, aren't we? No, we are not, they would say. And I think that that's right. And I think that there is cause for offense when you basically doing this kind of process of trivializing a person's beliefs about the nature of reality by saying, you know, you're just a blind man touching an elephant, and that we're all reading off the same page. And I think at the same time as well, it's very dishonest to say all paths lead to God or whatever, all paths lead to the same place, is dishonest for anyone who knows even just a few things about the way that the world's faiths operate. Because we know that they're not reconcilable. We know they teach different things. And so to continue on with the contemporary postmodern, everything's cool, it's all the same, you know, this type of deal is not true. And you know it's not true. And we have to come to terms with what the real content of a faith is, and does that really make sense and why? Let's move on to a second question here. You know, what about the fact that there are people who are profoundly sincere in their beliefs? They may be different than your beliefs, but they're very sincere about those beliefs. And who are we to say then, well, you must be, you know, wrong, or it's a possibility that you're wrong here, right? We would think that it's just not appropriate for a person who has sincere beliefs to be interacted with in this way. In our culture, that would be considered what? Maybe like disrespectful or closed-minded or something like that. So is sincerity of belief enough to say, you know, end of discussion? There's no point in our talking, and we shouldn't talk. It would be wrong. You know, I think that the Bible says, and this passage we're looking at really clear makes this clear, that we have to have a high regard for who people are and what they believe. Absolutely. And I think that it has been a mistake that has been very evident that Christians often have been extremely insensitive about what people believe and the path that they've been on and why they've come to the conclusions that they have come to and have been over, and have been more or less dismissed wholesale. That is a problem, and that's not what it means to be gentle and reverent in our interactions with people. What we're saying is that we should have in our interactions with other people who sincerely believe something very different than us, whether you're here as a Christian or not, that should be shrouded in a desire to openly explore. How did a person come to this viewpoint? You know, and what function does it have in their life? And why, as a rational person, do they believe it? And things like that. Those are important questions. Those are, you know, crucial in terms of establishing real rapport and real common ground often. But at the same time, I think it's important for us to note that one measure of sincerity is our willingness to dialogue honestly, including the possibility that we are wrong or self-deceived. Sincerity, in other words, alone is not a measure of what's true. And the world in history is full of the corpses of people who earnestly, passionately, sincerely believe things that just didn't end up being true. Jesus says, seek and you shall find. Jesus isn't afraid of our seeking, of our asking questions, but seeking with the idea that there is something out there to be found. That's the issue. The person who believes that they're terminal disease can be cured by reciting poetry or whatever may be very, very sincere and very passionate in that belief. Probably is, in fact. But, you know, sincerity is not the final word. And if we love people, then we will enter into dialogue with them so that they can begin processing through, why do I believe what I do? And maybe, just maybe, there's something I haven't seen yet. Some information that I've not really digested. Some real evidence, perhaps, that would suggest that there's a different way. And so what does it mean for us then to give an account for the hope that is within us? It's that. It's to have sincere dialogue with sincere people who are real. Issues are put out on the table in a respectful environment where we can interact with those things and so that people can draw their conclusions with the confidence that as people seek in a real, authentic way, where they have the category in their minds, it's possible that I'm wrong, it's possible that I'm self-deceived. The truth of Jesus' words is, man, God will reveal himself. God will clarify that to them. I think that's very important. And lastly, you know, what about, you know, so Jesus makes these bold claims, you know, nobody can come into the presence of God except for by me. He is the narrow gate, as he says. You know, but what about people who've never heard of Christ? And I think that's a big question in my mind, in many of our minds here, because it seems like we're condemning perhaps even the majority of humanity to eternal separation from God just because of an accident of birth. They just didn't happen to be born at the right place and at the right time to hear the message. Well, that seems really screwed up. Does that seem screwed up to you? That seems screwed up to me. And what I want us to do is think about this just a little bit. Because the Bible does not real specifically address this question. And in fact, we'll find that biblically minded Christians land in slightly different places on this point. But what we can do is appeal to biblical examples and biblical principles to begin to get at this question. This question that is a conversation stopper, an investigation stopper for so many people in our culture. There are two principles that I think the Bible does make clear. Namely, one, that you're responsible for what you do know. We're not held responsible for what we do not or cannot know. We are responsible for what we do know. So, for instance, in the Old Testament, there were not Christians in the Old Testament. And there's a good reason for that. You know what the reason is? Because Jesus hadn't come yet. Okay? So nobody in the Old Testament was a Christian. And nobody is approaching God on the basis of the cross of Christ, like Jesus describes in John 14:6. No one can come to the Father but through me. And yet we have many examples of people who we know to be right with God and who are, even as we speak here this evening, in the conscious presence of God and will be forever. Why is Abraham the example par excellence in the Bible of what does it mean to be right with God? Because he exercised faith in the things that God revealed to him. And that's the only reason. And so Paul makes that argument really strongly in the book of Galatians. He came long before Christ. But when God did reveal things to him, namely the promise that he would make of him a great nation and so forth, Abraham, it says, believed God. And it was accounted to him as righteousness or right standing with God. And so that's an important example. He's responsible for what he does know. We're told by Paul in Romans chapter 1 that at the end of the day, even without any kind of revelation from the Bible of any kind, in what we call general revelation, God has revealed himself to every human being. He says, inwardly, by the testimony of our own conscience, our own moral awareness, our own recognition that human beings have value and have worth and have guilt, that these things point to a God who really is there. And that all human beings possess this basic internal compass pointing to God. And he says further, by the very design of the universe itself, its complexity, its order, the fact that it follows along, not in chaos, but according to the dictates of a reasonable God who really did make it, that this too points to the reality of a truly existing infinite and personal God. And so what about people who've never heard about Jesus Christ or whatever? There are contexts of accountability that God has built into the fiber of their own being. At the end of the day, what will we say about the many people who've just never really got it? They don't understand what the Christian message is. I think at the end of the day, in my experience, and it's been helpful for me to think about this, as I don't know, I cannot read into another person's heart. I cannot know what's in their heart. I don't know where that person necessarily is with God, but I know that God does. And I know that God is good and that God is just, and I can entrust to him the answer to this question. And for some of us, maybe that's just a broad intellectual question, a matter of just curiosity. For some of us, this may be a very personal issue, as it was for me as I was watching my father die, not really knowing if he ever really understood grace and the love of God. That wasn't his background, that wasn't his experience. His understanding of Christianity was a narrow, rigid, law-oriented, judging and rejecting kind of faith. And as much as we would try to discuss this stuff, he just wouldn't have anything to do with it. Where is he? I don't know. But I know that God is good and God is just, and no one comes to the Father but through Christ. And that I think that that's just, in a broad sense, I realize we've covered a lot of ground here. That's how we have to engage this question of the exclusive and universal claims of Jesus Christ in the light of the kinds of questions that this brings out in our culture. And let's just think very briefly about where to go from here. You know, unlike maybe the person in some super remote Stone Age culture or somewhere in New Guinea, although most of them are Christians now, actually, there are a lot more Christians in Asia than there are in Europe and in America. I don't know if you realize that. But I don't think that, you know, when we think about this question, what about those who've never heard and so forth, that's an interesting question theoretically, but it's not a very appealing question personally. You have heard. You do know what the message is. And so it may be in the back of your mind, I don't know how God is going to engage these people who've never heard these things, but I've heard. I've heard. And so, you know, maybe you're here tonight and you don't really know how you're putting the pieces of what you're hearing together. And you want more information and you need to think things through. And we invite you to do that, to explore, to ask questions. God's not afraid of your questions. You can dig as deeply as you want, and God is in those questions. And I invite you to do that. Others of us are at a different place, and we've done some of that exploration. And it will not do within our own conscience, and certainly before God, to say, well, I'm interested in Christianity, but, you know, what about, you know, the intolerance thing? What about people who've never heard? You know, the reality is that God will deal in his own way with those issues. You've been presented with information, and you're accountable to God for how you respond. It's not enough just to say that's interesting and move on. Or I believe that in some kind of a vague and intellectual sense. I'm sure that must be true. Biblical faith means that I have worked my way through a process of investigation. I've still got my questions. I've been a Christian for 30 years. I still have my questions. But I am convinced enough that I'm prepared to put the weight of my faith and of my life on the claims of Jesus Christ. And God is calling on you to do that tonight. If you're at that place where you have thought this stuff through, you sense that what you're hearing really is true, I urge you, take that time just to come before God and say, I have reason to believe that this is true. I have come to terms with my own alienation from you, my own guilt before you. I have come to that place where I believe that Jesus is who he says he is, that he is the Son of God, that he did die on the cross for my sin. And I'm asking you, God, in this moment, will you apply Christ's death to my life and allow me to be reconciled to you through that? And that's what God is calling on you to do. And the reality is that where you spend your life and where you spend your eternity, not on because I'm a religious bigot and this is the way I see it, but on the authority of Christ's words, that is the crossroads of time and eternity, that decision that you make. I'd like you to hear Gary Salmon's story as how he put some of these things together. I think it's very compelling.
I'm a trial lawyer in a large law firm here in Columbus, Ohio. Law school does teach people critical thinking. You basically take truth claims and you tear them apart and you see if they're really true. And that's what jury trials are all about. Someone invited me to a Bible study and I went not because I was really curious about the Bible study, but because I had two friends who had gone to a Bible study in Cincinnati, and I went to get them out. People who simply were weak in the mind. And that's terrible to say, but that is what I came. Law school makes you skeptical and cynical. because you are constantly looking behind the rules and looking behind the power structure. And so I came with a skeptic's mind. These people talked about God as if he was real, and I had never seen that before in my life. Here was a group of people who actually supported one another, who cared about each other, who encouraged one another, who forgave one another. And I had not seen that anywhere. And I began to realize that everything that I thought I knew about who God was, and everything that I thought I knew about what the Bible said, was not really accurate. And it took me about a year before I came to Christ. The first year, people began telling me about their stories. I had a good friend in the first home group who spent a lot of time with me, running with me, who basically made time two or three times a week, an hour, out of their life to get to know me and to do something that I would like to do. And that, in that case, it was running. And he shared with me what Christ had done in his life, what a difference it had made in his marriage, in his family, in his outlook towards life. And this was someone who was, in my eyes, was, you know, just a terrific person, had the right values, and was living the kinds of values that I wanted to live. You know, my process of decision making was pretty much on a rational level. I was going to, you know, look at the evidence and make a decision based on the evidence. But the people's testimony about what God had been doing in their lives allowed me to suspend judgment long enough to listen. There were a number of teachings, I think, that were very influential in my decision to accept Christ. I mean, I heard the teaching on Isaiah, and a teaching in Daniel 9, and Psalm 22. I heard the prophecies, and began to look at them closer and to study the evidence. Is this, was it in fact, can we, you know, date these prophecies to a certain date through carbon dating? Can we establish through secular sources the accuracy and the verifiability of these prophecies? If you decide that the resurrection is a historical fact, the implications are enormous. And I took a look at that question, and you know, there are a lot of non-Christian sources that tell us who Jesus was, that he performed miracles, that he was crucified, and up to the empty tomb. And at the point of the empty tomb, then you have to decide, did he rise from the dead? You know, the Bible is filled with eyewitness accounts of that. And eyewitness accounts is fairly persuasive evidence. And having looked at the evidence, I ultimately decide, you know, the resurrection is a historical fact. We convict people and send people to jail all the time through circumstantial evidence and eyewitness testimony. And eyewitness testimony is better than circumstantial evidence, but they're all good evidence. And you look at people's motivation to lie and whether they had a motive to lie. When you start reading the Gospels and you start reading the literature and you realize how much, first of all, how much non-Christian sources there are to back up Jesus' ministry, and then the eyewitness accounts of the apostles, and then what their motives were, the fact that these people were willing to go to their deaths rather than to say something that they knew to be untrue, that could have saved their lives. That's fairly compelling. I would be happy to take that case to court with the kind of eyewitness testimony that the gospel offers. Having looked at that from a legal perspective and weighed the evidence from a legal perspective, I thought, wow, this compels a decision. And I made one. I've seen what the gospel can do in people's lives. I've seen what Christ can do in people's lives. I was a beneficiary of that, of people who were willing to put out their lives and to share with me what was going on in their lives, to share what God was doing in their lives, to share the struggles of their lives, to encourage me, to forgive me, to extend me grace. Wow, I've received a lot. I need to do that with other people. I need to extend that kind of love to other people, and to tell them about Christ, and to help them have the kind of grounding that I received. It's a joy. It's what I'm about.
Yes, that is what he's about. Some heavy firepower to have on our side. Last point. You know, for us who are here this evening and we have met Christ, and that case has been kind of resolved in our minds. You know, the real question this text is asking is, you know, who will you give an account for the hope that's within you? Because God has placed you where you are in space and time, because there are many people who have not heard of what the gospel is, what God is offering. It is our commission, our job, to stand in the gap and to be an ambassador for Christ. In his book, Spontaneous Expansion of the Church, Roland Allen says, he says, the Spirit of Christ is a spirit who longs for and strives after the salvation of souls of men, and that spirit dwells in us. That spirit converts the natural instinct to live for self, to be self-protective, to worry about what other people think, into a longing for the conversion of others, which is indeed divine in source and character. And that's what the Spirit of God inside of you as a believer in Jesus Christ is pleading with you to be sensitive to and to respond to. And so, there you have one of the great thoughts that dominate our culture, the exclusive nature of the Christian message. Next week, we want to come back and we want to get into this troubling discussion of judgment. You know, why would a good God judge people? Why would a good God judge, you know, the nice feller next door and the Adolf Hitlers of the world, and more or less view them as being in the same pie? You know, there's something strange about that. There's something counterintuitive about that. There's something about that that, at the end of the day, for many of us, really kind of pisses us off. And we need to get to the bottom of that question. That's where we'll go next week. Listen, we are really running late, so I'm just going to close us in prayer. And hopefully we'll be able to continue this conversation. I think this is a big deal. And certainly what we're going to talk about next week also is a big deal. So, Lord, just thanks for the fact that you really are there. And Lord, help us just to not trivialize that knowledge as just some sort of a matter of taste, something that we choose to believe, but that we have our faith really rooted in the things that Gary was talking about on this little video piece of investigation, of putting pieces together, and at the end of the day realizing I'm either going to stand inside and ask my questions, or I'm going to stand outside and ask my questions. And I just plead, Lord, on the authority of your word, that you are tonight even calling people to interact with you in a personal way, to seek you, to ask God, you know, tell me, what is the, what are the reasons? What is the case? And for some of us, we've kind of sifted that through and we have some things that we're convinced of. Lord, I pray that this would be a time just to come before you to say, you know, I want you in my life. I'm prepared to receive Christ for me. Lord, help us to be a community of people that really demonstrate your reality through how we interact with one another. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.